Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We all know Flint is struggling with lead in its water, but every older city in the state, or across the nation actually, has a lead legacy. Coming up, we'll talk with an expert about one of those risks, working in your garden with soil contaminated by lead.
We always encourage and, in fact, insist that we have a soil test run before planting a new food garden in an urban area.
Later this hour, we'll find out how the lead got there and what you can do to make things safer. But first, when the Environment Report covers the spread of a Lyme disease-carrying tick, as it did this week, lots and lots of people pay attention. So I asked the host of the Environment Report, Rebecca Williams, to spend a couple of minutes with us to discuss the latest. It's tick time. Rebecca, what tick spreads Lyme disease?
So it's called the black-legged tick, and it is the tick in Michigan that can carry the bacteria that can transmit the disease.
So what does this thing look like? What would you check for?
So, well, this time of year, it's in the nymph stage, and it's really tiny. It's about the size of a poppy seed. So it can be hard to see. Later, of course, the adults are bigger. You can go on our website, michiganradio.org, and see a graphic from the CDC. And you'll look on that graphic, and you see that these ticks, even as adults, they're next to a dime. So we're talking small.
Really tiny. So where are we likely to pick up one of these ticks?
So the highest risk, according to the state health department, is along the western side of Michigan, but these ticks are on the move, and so they're expanding their range eastward. And so I've been told that really you need to keep your eyes open no matter where you are because they are moving east.
So anywhere along the coast, the west coast and east, they're moving that direction, so they could be maybe in Lansing or anywhere like that.
It's possible. It's possible. They are starting to find them farther east.
So what are we supposed to check on? I mean, what does it look like if we get a bite?
So the CDC says that about 70 to 80% of people will have a classic bullseye rash, this rash that's red and expands out in a circle. But not everybody gets that. And so you want to also pay attention for fever, body aches. Sometimes you can get facial paralysis. You can even have fatigue, headache, those kind of things. And if it's not treated, it can get a lot worse. You can have a wider range of symptoms. It can include things like severe joint pain, irregular heartbeat, spinal and brain inflammation. So it can get really serious.
Oh, Lyme disease sounds pretty scary. So this is something that I guess deer and other wildlife are carrying with them that's traveling that way. And these are mostly in shaded areas, like you said. So what do we do to avoid them? What can we do to keep them off us?
So the experts recommend using repellent. DEET is one of the things that CDC and the State Health Department talk about. You can also use other things. There are some natural alternatives listed on CDC's site as well. And so they recommend that, especially on your legs, because what the ticks do is they like to go up on the edge of vegetation on the sides of trails, and they do something called questing, and they look for prey. So they're looking for things like deer and birds is what they normally ride on, but they'll also attach to us. And then they'll crawl up your legs and crawl up your clothing. And you want to make sure you do a tick check when you get back inside, look behind your ears and all those places where they might like to hide.
Take a shower and take a look. Yep.
That's right.
All right. That's Rebecca Williams with the Environment Report talking about the Lyme disease carrying six-legged tick. Thanks.
You're welcome.
I just want to hear from you. What stories are you looking at? What issues do you want to hear more about? Let us know. Find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside. We're also on Twitter, at Stateside Radio, and, of course, at MichiganRadio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. Detroit is getting some love in Venice. The Venice Architecture Biennale is a really big deal in the architecture world, and the U.S. designs this year, the U.S. Pavilion, they're all about Detroit. This year, four different sites in Detroit are being reimagined by architects from around the U.S. One of those sites, by the way, is the old Packard Auto Plant. Stateside spoke with the exhibit's co-curators, Cynthia Davidson and Monica Ponce de Leon, back in November.
The sites themselves all speak to the condition of the post-industrial city and the kind of transition that not just Detroit, but many cities around the world are having to make in rethinking the nature of the city when heavy industry isn't the primary focus of the city any longer.
One of the main things we're asking the architects is to understand the context of Detroit today, the reality of Detroit today, and use it as a backdrop for future speculation. So when they came to Detroit to visit the sites, they spent a lot of time meeting with community groups, meeting with business owners, meeting with nonprofits, so that they really get a cross-section of what is happening in Detroit today and use that as a catalyst for new ways of thinking about urban problems.
You can find that full interview we did with the exhibit's co-curators at michiganradio.org. Joining me right now from Venice, Italy, is Bryce Detroit, who represents a coalition of Detroit activists and artists who are concerned about whether Detroit's bigger issues are getting lost in all of this exhibit. The group is called Detroit Resists. So what's your concern about the Detroit exhibits at the Biennale?
First, Lester, thank you for this opportunity. Detroit Resists is a platform to uplift a legacied movement, this movement that has been active for the past 35, almost 40 years now. Community members, activists, artists, designers coming together to recreate space, reimagine community, as well as bring attention to those really specific community issues. So for us, our presence here, we were invited to participate in events to broadcast and to share this alternative method that is being employed and producing measurable community results. If we were to frame it from a concern standpoint, then the concern is a dominant media narrative that has been just very prevalent of this blank slate, blank canvas, and the whole consumption of that narrative by so many people to the point where a process can happen that is absent and void of the legacied cultural identities and the narratives of the African and indigenous people in Detroit.
Okay, so basically you're saying, hey, we've had this whole movement of ruin porn. Now you're trying to redesign our city as if it's a blank canvas when there's lots of history here. There are people here. There are things that you should know about our city before you start making plans to wipe it away and start over anew. Is that right?
Absolutely, because that process is already being employed in many communities for decades, and it's working. So there is an alternative method.
I understand you're there with Andrew Hersher. He's a professor at the University of Michigan. He's also in Venice with you. Can we speak with him?
Yes, one moment, please. Hello.
Hi, Andrew. So you are a professor of architecture. What are you seeing at the Biennale, and what do you think about Detroit being the central focus of the U.S. portion?
I'll speak as a member of Detroit Resists, not as a professor of architecture at the University of Michigan.
Okay, different hats then. But yeah. I think that gives you some credibility to speak to this issue that you might not otherwise have.
Yeah, but it also goes to the point that Detroit Resists is a cross-disciplinary, intergenerational, multiracial collective of people who are bringing all sorts of their own varied interests, their own background to the common cause that Bryce was just describing to you. But anyway, you know, I think we Detroit Resist, acknowledge the light that the U.S. Pavilion is shining on Detroit, but I think we have a different opinion about what that light should illuminate. In the U.S. Pavilion, that light is illuminating the speculative projects by this national group of visionary architects. We think the light could very profitably illuminate the kind of architecting that communities in Detroit are doing by themselves, for themselves, or in some cases collaboratively with like-minded artists, architects, and designers. But one of the things that we in Detroit Resist, I think, want to emphasize is that architecture is not only a profession, it's not only a discipline, it's a practice, and it's a practice that communities can carry out, as well as people who have the kind of institutional entitlement that schools of architecture offer. This also has something to say to architecture, because what it means is architects don't only have to make buildings for communities. Architects can also co-create spaces with communities. And the kind of work that Bryce described to you that we're really interested in lifting up is more the latter sort of architecture and premised upon a really sort of different relationship between architects and communities.
That's Andrew Hersher. He, along with Bryce Detroit, from whom we heard earlier, are members of Detroit Resist. They are at the Venice Architecture Biennale, which, as I mentioned, is a big deal in the architecture world. And the entire U.S. exhibit this year is about Detroit.
Thanks very much for your perspective.
Okay.
By the way, Detroit Resist is using an app which virtually occupies the U.S. pavilion at the Venice Architecture Biennale. Basically, visitors can view the exhibit and their cell phone will reveal digital slogans and images as part of the visual experience, including slogans such as "Respect Existence" or "Expect Resistance." On their website, they write, quote, "We had our doubts that a dozen groups of architects who airdrop into the city were likely to produce work that honors the struggles of the people who've lived in a city with declining services, water shutoffs, mortgage ripoffs, and county confiscations. Instead," the group continues, "we guess the organizers were mining Detroit for its momentary cool factor." Next, the golf industry isn't doing all that great right now. Michigan has lost 200 golf courses in the past 15 years.
Back in the late 90s, we were charging as much as we're charging in, 2015. So the golf prices have not risen that much.
We'll find out what's behind the drop-off and what can be done about it. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Market forces have decided Michigan has too many golf courses. An article in the Detroit Free Press looked at the boom of golf courses in recent decades turning into a painful bust, as the headline reads. Joining us to talk further about this is Paul Duda, who manages the Rambler Golf Course in Sterling Heights. It's been a popular course since 1929. At its peak, Michigan had close to 1,000 golf courses, and today fewer than 800. What's happening?
Well, a couple of things have happened. Of course, we had a pretty good recession for golf starting in, when the recession hit in Michigan in 2008. But a lot of golf courses were sold for real estate. In fact, first golf course I was at was a place called Partridge Creek. And back in 2004, we had 45 holes there with a banquet facility. A big group came along and bought all 350 acres, put a big outside mall in and housing development, and it was sold. To be honest with you, it was sold for a lot of money, upwards to $40 million. And when you're in the golf business, it'd take you 200 years to make that kind of money in golf.
Right.
So they sell. And that's what's been happening, too. A lot of golf courses in the good economy sold. And now that it's coming back, there's more golf courses in our area sold just recently here.
Well, let's go back a few years. With so many golf courses being built, the assumption at the time was the return on investment would be great. But with more golf courses came more competition. The green fees lowered, and that caused problems. Is that the main reason that we saw that?
I totally believe that, because they built so many golf courses, and then there weren't the golfers to fill them. And then prices had to come down. I'll be honest with you, back in the late 90s, we were charging as much as we're charging in, 2015. So the golf prices have not risen that much. Your expenses have stayed and gone up, but if you want to be competitive, you have to have competitive prices.
There's a change in demographics, too. I know the baby boomers still hit the links, but it seems the younger generations are not as enthusiastic. What seems to be the reason for that, and what can you do about it?
I don't know if they have a short attention span or they're not willing to spend 4 or 5 hours playing golf, or it doesn't interest them. I don't know. But you know what? Being in the golf business, I still see a lot of young kids playing. We run junior camps, and they're very popular. So I think the main emphasis for a golf course is your location, to be honest with you. If you're in a good spot, I'm in a great spot in a metropolitan area close to the, the auto companies and for leagues and stuff, and that is what's helped us maintain our business.
You mentioned what happened to Partridge Creek, the golf course you used to manage, and how it was developed. Is that usually what becomes of the property on these other golf courses?
Yeah, I can just tell you around here in the Macomb County area, you know, there was Rochester, which was an old school golf course, a nice place that became a housing development. Wolverine was a 36-hole golf course that was sold intentionally to be real estate. Finally now, that was back in 2004 or 2005. Right now they're starting to develop it. That was a kind of a bust for a while. Recently here, there's a golf course called Sunnybrook that's been there since the 20s that was just sold for automotive. So, I mean, it's hard for an owner to turn down that kind of money when the golf business is iffy, you know? So I think that caused a lot of people to sell.
The Free Press article quoted a golf course architect who thinks that the state could lose 30 or more courses each year for the next 2 or 3 years before demand and supply are in balance. What do you think of that prediction?
I don't have the stats, but I wouldn't be surprised, because if the economy is good, then that land value is better. And, you know, there's more and more developing and there's more interest in the land. So, you know, there's another golf course here called Maple Lane. It's one of the oldest golf courses, 90 years old. It was just sold last year. It's over on Van Dyke and 14 Mile Road here near the Tech Center. Was sold to the Mosheri Builders, who's going to build homes on it. They're going to maintain maybe 18 holes, maybe 27, but they're going to develop homes around it. So I don't doubt that more and more golf courses are going to sell if the economy stays strong.
What's Rambler's future look like?
It's good because of the fact of my land. I have a par 3, which is in front, and then the back, the Clinton River runs through it, so there's a lot of floodplain. And we're here, and we're here to stay. So
right, nobody gonna be buying the flood insurance for that.
No. You know what? And to be honest with you, we're in a pretty good position right now with the golf courses around us selling. That now we're more in demand, and I actually added 200 league players from last year to this year because of that Sunnybrook golf course closing. So that helps.
So you're getting some clientele just simply because golf courses around you are closing.
Right, and. You know, Michigan still has the most public golf courses in the country, more than Florida, more than California. And that's with losing 200 golf courses, you know, over 15, 16 years. So I think a few more have to go, and that's good for the golf course owners, you know, and the businesses.
The ones who remain, right.
The ones that remain will be strong.
That's Paul Duda. He manages the Rambler Golf Course in Sterling Heights. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you very much. Take care.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham.
He said, you know, we need to look for another church. It's not you. I always felt like I was being broken up with. It's not you. We just need to date other churches.
And now, a story from Failure Lab. Jeff Mannion is a senior pastor at Ada Bible Church in Grand Rapids.
I'm Jeff, and at the age of 21, I became the pastor of Ada Bible Church, east of Grand Rapids, Michigan. Now, I do not remember applying for the job. I did not interview. I don't remember auditioning. The official word, I guess, is a candidate. Our plan was not to stay in Grand Rapids. My wife, Chris, and I, we met our senior year of high school, Sacramento, California. We met there, started dating, came out to Grand Rapids to go to Bible school. Bible college, and before my senior year of Bible college, we were married, and our plan was to come back for 1 year, finish up, and then head back out to the western states and do ministry of some sort. That was the plan before the phone call. A guy by the name of Marty called, and he says, hey, I attend Ada Bible Church. Our pastor has resigned. Would you be willing to fill in for one Sunday? I said, absolutely, absolutely. I'd done this before. Preached, that is. Twice. At my father's church on Wednesday night, I was a wild success among the elderly people who attended my father's church on Wednesday night. But I said, sure, and I drove out to Ada Bible Church. It was on a dirt road. It was a small, it was a house structure. It's like 50, 60 folding chairs were set up. And again, it was on a dirt road. It's not only that Ada Bible Church was irrelevant to Grand Rapids. People in the village of Ada had never heard of Ada Bible Church. You know, immediately, I thought that they should kind of change the logo to Ada Bible Church, the church you've been looking for. Because you could look and not find Ada Bible Church. So finished preaching that weekend, and that was that. And then 2-3 weeks later, phone rings again, and it's Marty. And he says, can you preach 2 Sundays? And I said, sure. The money was good. It's $25 a sermon. Some of them were worth it. And then Marty called again a while later and said, would you be willing to fill in until we find a real pastor? So, that was 32 years ago. They are still looking. And we stayed. We made Grand Rapids our home. And lo and behold, we were kids, but the church started to grow as the college students and young couples made this ministry their home. Remember the little podium that was up there at the front? Sanctuary was 24 feet wide. I know that because it was the size of a 2-stall garage. When we ended up finally selling it and someone turned it into a house, the sanctuary is where the garage was in the future. But next to the podium in front, to the left-hand side, there was this old-school attendance board, the kind with the grooves in it where they would slide in numbers every week for, like, the attendance the week before and the offering the week before. And up at the top, it was the record attendance. Now, our first weekend there is like 20, 25 people, including kids. Just a financial tip for you. If you're looking for a fast track to financial security, do not become the pastor of a church of 25 people. Just saying. But there at the top of the attendance board was like the record attendance. It was like 67 people, and it started to climb. It started to move. Remember when we had 72 people, and then 79, and 85, and 89, and 92, and 100 for the first weekend ever, a couple of years in, and then 105, and 117 people. Now, I know that now, in the advent of the megachurch, a church of 117 people is not exactly astounding. But at the time, the growth was intoxicating. I mean, going from 25 to 50, my friends, that's 100% growth rate. 50 to 100, that was 100% again. And so things were growing. They were moving in the right direction. The church owned 12 acres. We wanted to sell this house on the dirt road, get out of that place, and get into a respectable building and a respectable location. And so we announced next April we were going to be building. And that added even more momentum. I live kind of out in the country, and sometimes I walk outside and can smell the wood smoke coming from some neighbor's wood-burning stove. Success has an aroma. And when things are going well and momentum is growing, it's like you can smell it in the air. So we announced the next April we were going to be building. I've discovered something, that competence in one area does not necessarily mean competence in another area. That is that if you garner the proficiency of learning how to pray with people before a surgery or officiate a really painful funeral, that doesn't necessarily give you the ability to build anything. I wasn't qualified to build a doghouse and was leading the charge in this building campaign to relocate. So I'd never had any skill or ability at raising the tens of thousands of dollars necessary to build the building. And time kind of got away from us, and so we were arriving at that April, and it became clear to all of us in leadership that we didn't have our plan together, we didn't have the money we needed, we were pretty much broke. And so I remember the day that I stepped up to the podium and as April approached and said, hey, listen, we knew we said that we were going to build this year, but our plan isn't together, our funding isn't in place. We would rather wait a year than to race into a building project that we really aren't prepared for. That weekend, after I was done, people thanked me. Thank you for not leading us into a building program that we're not ready for. And so we prepared for the next April, but during that year, a factory approached us, and they said, the 12 acres you own, we would love to put a factory there. Would you be willing to sell to us? And they made this offer to us that felt at the time just extraordinarily high, and with that money, we could buy new property and then have like a down payment for this building. But the wheels turned so slowly on their end and on our end, put together a search committee, looked for a new property, and the clock was ticking. And so the next year, I had the wonderful leadership opportunity of walking up to the podium and saying, you know, we said it was going to be this year. But, you know, we've had this property opportunity, and it's not in place. it'll be next year that we'll build. Strange thing, I rake my memory. For the life of me, I cannot remember anybody thanking me after that announcement. And we did find other property. And we designed a new plan, building plan for the new property. And our funding wasn't together. And the next year, 3 years in a row, had a wonderful leadership opportunity of saying, I know I said it would be this year, but it'll be next April. Honest. And during those 3 years of delays, we grew from 100 down to about 50. Now, these were not numbers. These were people. These were families. These were people that we had worshipped with, that we had laughed with, and in some cases, cried with. And it didn't dwindle all at once, but the attendance board next to the podium, had still, the record attendance was still the same, 117, but last week's attendance dropped into the 90s and the 80s and the 70s and the 60s. It came to rest in the 50s. Three years of spinning our wheels trying to get the traction to get out of that stinking house on that stinking dirt road. And the way a family leaves is often it'd be the husband that would call and he would say, hey, I'm wondering if we can go out to coffee. And I go, no coffee. And sit down across from coffee. And he'd say, we need to look for another church. It's not you. I always felt like I was being broken up with. It's not you. We just need to date other churches. And of course, when a family decides, yeah, we just want to look for something else, you don't run an announcement in the bulletin that says, the Wilsons have abandoned us. Someone would just come up and they'd go, hey, I haven't seen Bob and Donna around here for a while. So, yeah, They decided to look for a different church. And for each couple or individual that would leave, and by the way, the evidence was on their side that we really weren't going anywhere, you'd have that conversation 2, 3, 4 times. I felt like I was dying a slow death. I remember the shame. Coroner's report would read, death by humiliation. And then the weight would grow heavier on those of us that were still there. I mean, just the basic things, mowing the lawn, cleaning the church building, guarding the nursery so no kids escaped, and the financial burden came to rest on fewer and fewer shoulders. 7 years into our journey, we sold the house on a dirt road and moved into a rented high school auditorium. I was no longer 21. I was no longer a newlywed. I was approaching 28, had 2 small children. Soon the third would be on the way. And our net gain in almost 7 years of pouring our life into this place was going from a church of 25 to going to a church of about 50 people. Now, individuals enter ministry for a number of reasons and out of diverse motivations, and yet I entered ministry in order to be a colossal disappointment to myself and everyone around me, is rarely mentioned among them. My dad was a preacher. I was raised in a pastor's home. I was not totally naive. See, I knew that there would be days of disappointment. I just didn't realize that there would be years of disappointment. I didn't realize that there would be years of being a disappointment. Some days I walk to the mailbox out on our road and I can smell the distant scent of wood smoke coming from someone's wood-burning fireplace. Success has an aroma, and failure has an aroma. When things are falling apart, you can smell it in the air.
Thank you.
That was Jeff Mannion, senior pastor at Ada Bible Church in Grand Rapids. We'll hear more of these stories on the stateside from our partners at Failure Lab. You can find out more at failure-lab.com. Coming up, a new book explores invasive species and the battle for the future of the Great Lakes.
In order to get people really interested and willing to take action, I think that they have to see changes with their own eyes.
That's in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. If you live in Flint, your water is contaminated with lead. Once you figure out a way to filter it or stop drinking with it, cooking with it, bathing with it, you start thinking about other uses. For instance, if you grow a garden and you watered that garden the last couple of years with lead-contaminated water, should you be concerned? With us to talk about that is Teresa McLean. She's a Michigan State University Extension Service educator in community food systems in Flint. Flint residents are being encouraged to eat foods high in iron, calcium, and vitamin C because it helps stop the absorption of lead. So could you raise tomatoes, peppers, leafy greens in your garden? Should you?
Yes, Lester, there's been many, many questions about that. And we did begin back in the fall after it was publicly acknowledged that we had lead in our drinking water supply. We started to receive questions on that. And first step we took was to reach out to Michigan State University environmental chemists about that question of, okay, if we've been watering with lead-tainted water, have we affected our soil lead levels? The first step was to run some calculations on a known community garden that our local urban agriculture initiative, Edible Flint, manages. And we were able to give factors such as the square footage, the amount of water that had been applied over the growing season, the lead level in the water that had been applied. We had the previous soil test results, as that's part of our Edible Flint programming. We always encourage and, in fact, insist that we have a soil test run before planting a new food garden in an urban area. And so what happened were that the results came back a bare trace amount of lead had been added over an entire growing season. The environmental chemist explained to us that it would not be a significant source. So our first and foremost concern is what is already in soils.
Right, because that's a problem. Old lead paint from houses and outbuildings, lead from when we used to use lead gasoline. Even if you didn't use lead contaminated water to irrigate, how concerned should people be about checking that out?
Yeah, we have always moved forward with let's test first, because depending on what those results come back, we can make alternative suggestions.
Such as?
Raised beds, container gardens, selection of another spot. As you mentioned, those old historic sources of lead in the soil were often by heavily traveled roadways or in the drip lines of buildings that have been removed. Let's locate that garden away from those places initially, but still test EPA levels between 0 and 400 parts per million is considered low for gardening purposes. However, we add a few qualifiers to that. So lead does occur naturally in soils before those historic additions were added. And so in the range of 0 to like 70 parts per million, that can be found in any soil. We like to use the 300 parts per million limit, which is where we would want children not exposed beyond that limit for our soil for vegetable gardening. But interestingly, Lester, what we do to improve soils to grow gardens reduces the risk of lead from those gardens.
In what way?
The addition of compost, the addition of an additive to increase soil pH.
So you're basically diluting the lead content.
And somehow immobilizing it within the soil complex, and then very commonly recommended mulching because if you're in that higher lead level, towards that higher range of low, as I described, soil splash, the soil that gets stuck to our root vegetables or our leafy greens, could be a concern if not washed properly. And so we do recommend peeling all root crops and pulling off the outer leaf, the leafy greens. Of course, here in Flint, we have to wash them thoroughly with filtered or bottled water. And these are some of the things we do to reduce risk of lead. But I think your question about whether or not vegetables take up lead could be considered here.
Right, because a few years ago, I know scientists were studying phytoremediation, that is, using plants to take up heavy metals such as lead and other toxic stuff. They were testing grasses at the time, leafy vegetables, even lemon-scented geraniums, and they found that some plants were more efficient at taking up heavy metals than others. So how do we know which plants, which vegetables might be carrying or absorbing higher levels of lead than others?
Fortunately for us, vegetables are not very good at taking up lead. When we talk about low-risk vegetables, anything that fruits, Lester, like tomatoes, peppers, green beans, corn, if there is any lead uptake at all, it does not get translocated to the fruits. And so those are considered the safest type of vegetable to grow in a garden with elevated lead levels.
I want to make sure, so if you grow vegetables, the likelihood lead's not going to be a significant factor. Because I was going to ask you, let's say this summer your neighbor offers you some vegetables or there's someone selling some vegetables at the corner. Should you be concerned or should you just buy them and feel like this is a minimum risk?
We are strongly recommending that for the reasons of healthy food access and food security that people do continue to garden and grow their food and share their food. Again, the ways to reduce the risk is knowing what the soil lead level was in the first place and minimizing its mobility by adding that compost, by raising the pH, by covering with mulch. For those leafy crops and those root vegetables, make sure they're very thoroughly washed.
I've got one more question I want to ask, and that is, if you're watering this year and you're not going to run your garden hose through a filter, more than likely, are you running the risk of adding to your problem?
You're not appreciably adding to soil lead levels. But here in Flint, as part of our Edible Flint Garden Starters programming, with the support of a Michigan Department of Ag grant that we've just received, we are providing irrigation hose filters that remove lead. And really, Lester, that's just to minimize risks even further. But we can confidently say that vegetables do not readily take up lead. And if we are in an elevated lead situation, let's use those fruiting crops only, or raised beds or container gardens.
Teresa McLean works in Flint as an MSU Extension Educator and Community Food Services. Thanks very much for talking with us about this.
Thank you so much, Lester.
For nearly two decades, the Environment Report and its predecessor, the Great Lakes Radio Consortium, have been reporting about invasive species on Michigan radio. More and more kinds of pests are being introduced into the lakes, often by cargo ships bringing in critters from foreign ports. A new book is coming out. It's titled Lake Invaders, Invasive Species and a Battle for the Future of the Great Lakes. It was written by William Rapay, who joins us now. With the rate of new invasive species, you could publish an update, a revision of this book every other year. Why do you think we are still seeing so many introductions when we know most of the ways they're coming in and most of the ways we end up spreading them to inland lakes and rivers?
Thank you for having me, Lester. We're not really seeing that many new introductions coming in through ballast water. It's been, I want to say 9 years. I'm not sure that that's the right number. For the past decade or so, both the Canadian and U.S. Coast Guards have been requiring international ships to exchange their ballast water at sea.
Yeah, it's called swish and spit.
Exactly. Yeah. The whole idea behind ballast water is if a ship is traveling across the ocean, they want to make sure that their ballast tanks are filled with water in order to keep the ships steady. So you fill up your ballast tanks when you're empty with cargo, you fill it up with water in a port, you travel across the ocean, and you dump that water in the new port when you are filling up with cargo. So now the Coast Guards require the ships to empty their ballast water in the middle of the ocean and pick up salt water. And that process of transferring from fresh water to salt water is called osmotic shock, and it kills about 99% of all the organisms in a ballast tank. So that's been very effective, but there are other pathways.
Right, and it's not completely effective because there's sediment in the bottom of those ballasts sometimes and things can hide in there. But talk about some of these other ways that we're seeing invasives coming in.
Well, one of the ways that really surprised me and was surprisingly close to home was through classrooms. My own daughter, when she was in third grade, had rusty crayfish in their classroom in a science unit. And I haven't talked to the teacher, but I know that the teacher sent some of those crayfish home with students. They wanted them as pets. And I suspect that the parents, when those crayfish came home, the parents took one look at it and said, I don't want that thing in my house. And since I live in Grosse Pointe, I would imagine that the parents probably thought that they were doing the humane thing and took them down and put them in Lake St. Clair.
And this happens with not just rusty crayfish, but a lot of aquariums where there are exotics in them and they don't want the fish anymore or the seaweed or whatever that's in it. And it gets dumped in some body of water and there's another problem.
Absolutely. Once again, close to home, I have a nursery near my house in Grosse Pointe. Last fall, I went in and I found that nursery selling water hyacinth and water lettuce, which are both popular pond plants, but they are both illegal to sell in the state of Michigan. The legislature has outlawed the possession and sale of those plants because of the impact that they would have on the Great Lakes. But yet they were for sale right there down the street from my house, which was a real surprise.
I want to talk about the poster child for invasive species, the Asian carp. A lot of people know about that threat, but they're unaware of quagga mussels, which have had a vast impact on the lake, spiny water fleas, round gobies, and so on. What could be done to get people as agitated about these pests as the ones like fish that jump out of the water?
Well, I suspect it has to do with people actually seeing impacts. I have a lot of friends of mine who are anglers, and I know that they can no longer catch fish like walleye in Lake St. Clair because the water clarity level of Lake St. Clair has changed dramatically over the past 10 years because of the impact of zebra mussels and quagga mussels. They're filter feeders. They suck the plankton out of the water. It makes the water clear. A lot of people look at that water and say, "Oh, look how clear the water is. I can see to the bottom. The water must be great." Something's missing now, and that's the plankton. And because the walleye don't like that really bright, clear water, they have moved on. They've moved on to the eastern basin of Lake Erie. They've moved down to Saginaw Bay and Lake Huron. So people in my neighborhood can no longer catch a walleye in Lake St. Clair and parts of the Detroit River. In order to get people really interested and willing to take action, I think that they have to see changes with their own eyes.
Last time I counted, somebody told me there was something like 147 invasive species that have been introduced to the Great Lakes. The only one, as you note in the book, that we've been able to control basically is the lamprey, which was introduced in the 1940s. Is that correct?
1930s, 1940s, yes.
There's a huge amount of money spent to control that blood-sucking parasite. Basically, it attaches to fish and just they waste away as this lamprey sucks away the blood. There's no controlling many of these invasives. So how are they affecting? You mentioned how the quagga mussel were affecting the lakes. How are these other invasives causing problems?
Well, first of all, we have to make a distinction between a non-native species and introduced species. There are approximately 180 non-native species in the Great Lakes.
And some of them we like.
Right.
Like salmon.
Exactly. They've been introduced. So there's actually a rule that distinguishes between an invasive and an introduced species. For example, an introduced species would be the suckermouth minnow. It's there in the Great Lakes. It's really not having a whole lot of impact. But there are a handful of invasives that are having a huge impact, like the spiny water flea and the quagga mussel. And what we see the quagga mussels and the zebra mussels do is they're filter feeders. They sit on the bottom of the lake and they suck out the plankton. Not only have they made the water clear, but they've actually changed the water chemistry because they're using calcium. They're sucking calcium out of the water in order to make their own shells. The spiny water flea, which I find absolutely fascinating, a fascinating little creature. It's so small it could sit on the tip of your finger. but it has this barb on the end of its tail. And in order for that spiny water flea to be eaten by a fish, that fish has to be at least 20 times larger in order to digest it, because that barb will otherwise puncture the fish's stomach and the fish will die. If you are a fish that is big enough to eat a spiny water flea, you're actually getting a pretty good meal. But if you're that small, you take a great risk at eating a spiny water flea. But what the spiny water flea does, it affects both the trophic level above it and the trophic level below it, because it's eating everything, all the other plankton, zooplankton on that level. That means there's less zooplankton to eat the phytoplankton, and that means there's less zooplankton to be eaten by the bigger fish. Because the spiny water flea came in from Eastern Europe, it did not co-evolve with the plankton that are in the Great Lakes. And the plankton in the Great Lakes that are prey, they can detect a predator coming because they can feel a pressure wave, they can sense a chemical cue. With the spiny water flea, prey cannot detect that. And the prey is just getting wiped out by the superior predator.
We know that a lot of this has to be taken care of by government policy, but there are some things that we can do. Can you give us an idea of what anglers, for instance, or school teachers handing out rusty crayfish might do in the future to help reduce spreading some of these? You know, zebra mussel is a really good example. It started here in the Great Lakes, but it's across the entire nation now.
One of the things we can do is we can make sure that we're not transporting invasive or even, you know, just non-native species from lake to lake or location to location. We have to make sure that if we have our boat on a trailer, if we take it from one lake to another lake, we have to make sure that boat is clean and dry. We want to make sure that we're not taking any seaweed with us. That seaweed could potentially be Eurasian water milfoil. And just a tiny little fleck of that Eurasian water milfoil will go from one lake to another, fall into that other lake, and become established in the next lake. We talked a little bit about the spiny water flea a few minutes ago. Fish cannot digest, even though fish will eat spiny water flea eggs, they cannot digest spiny water flea eggs because they're in a hard case, and it will pass right through a fish's digestive tract. So let's say you're an angler, you've caught a fish, you've put it in your live well, and you're going to go to another lake. There's potential there that fish is going to excrete spiny water flea eggs, and you're going to take it to the next lake and potentially spread it to that next lake. We want to make sure that when we are moving our boats, that they are clean, that we have pulled those drain plugs, and that those boats are dry to make sure that we're not spreading anything to another location.
And that includes bait from one place to another, which can cause a lot of problems as well.
Absolutely, and that's one of the ways that the rusty crayfish got into the Great Lakes. Besides through classrooms, anglers were bringing them from their native area in the Ohio River, Ohio and Kentucky. I've never fished with crayfish, but I'm told that Great Lakes crayfish are not particularly good bait. So anglers will bring them the rusty crayfish up from Ohio and Kentucky. They will put a hook on it and use it as bait. And what happens at the end of the day when we're done with our bait? We just tend to dump it out into the water, thinking that, well, okay, we've got this bait. We don't no longer need it. What's the humane thing to do? We're going to put it back as a resource. Well, potentially that bait may not necessarily be from that lake. You may be introducing some kind of non-native into a new location. We all have to be aware of that.
William Rappe is the author of the book Lake Invaders, Invasive Species and the Battle for the Future of the Great Lakes. Thanks for coming in and telling us about the book.
Thank you, Lester.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Ryan Grimes, Josh Hakala, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.